Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today we've got David Cannadine talking about the Iron Lady herself, Margaret Thatcher.
Well, good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Timmy, thank you for that immensely kind introduction. Since, in part, I earn my living by speaking as well as writing, I have become an unrivaled connoisseur of introductions to myself. I have to say this is not a fiercely competed for position. I have never forgotten the occasion when I was on the road with my Life of Andrew Mellon. I was in an American city in the South, in Kansas. And there was a dinner, not as good a dinner as I've had tonight, but a very good dinner nevertheless. And after the dinner, I was due to give my talk about Andrew Mellon, my then biographical preoccupation. And the person in charge began the evening by saying, "It's a huge pleasure to welcome David Cannadine. He has produced the greatest biography of Andrew Mellon ever written." And I rather preened myself at this point and thought the evening promised well. He then, however, rather sported the effect by adding, "It is, of course, the only biography of Andrew Mellon ever written." So, Timmy, thank you so much for, as it were, not having said that. I belong to a generation. I was born in 1950, for whom Margaret Thatcher was therefore a figure of enormous influence and significance in the 1980s. And so one of the things that has hugely interested me about having the opportunity to write this short biography of her, apart from the fact that if you read my biography, you don't have to read Charles Moore's wonderful but rather lengthy biographies. This is bluff your way through Thatcher rather than read Charles Moore. Is the fact, of course, that I lived through the period when she was in power. And the chance to revisit as a historian and biographer that decade that I remembered and lived through was, in a sense, irresistible. But let me say a little more about my relationship with Margaret Thatcher before I get to, as it were, what I've written about her. I only met her in the 1990s, after she had been in power, and her glory days were, so to say, over. She chaired a committee at the University of London on which I sat. And the impressions that I had of her then and have kept with me since were the following. She was always impeccably turned out and she always wore blue suits. She was less physically prepossessing than the extraordinary career and political dominance would have led you to think that she ought to have been. She wasn't very tall, for example. But one always thought of her in her years of power and prime as being a person whose physical presence matched the political dominance. But that wasn't really true, it turned out. But I also remember feeling, as she chaired these meetings, that you could get a sense of how formidable a force she must have been in her prime, the sense of the mastery of business, the dominance of the agenda. But I also remember a moment which I thought was slightly to my credit, but was much more to hers, when we were going through an agenda of one of the meetings, and we came to a point, and the meetings were normally so constructed that there weren't many papers, and so we got through the agendas very rapidly. And I tried to hold up the meeting and make a point which wasn't quite the way the meeting was meant to go, and she turned to me and said, "I think that's a very good point that we really ought to consider." And I felt hugely pleased that the great lady had actually thought that I'd said something worth taking note of. But I was also struck by the fact that it implied a capacity to be open to other points of view, which the public image of her did not suggest she possessed. So that was my very limited acquaintance with her, except for the following further point. Many academics didn't like Mrs. Thatcher in the 1980s and didn't think she was worth taking seriously, that it would all sooner or later go away. I never quite had that view, and the reason I never quite had that view was the following, that much earlier in my life I had met, as it were, somebody who, in retrospect at least, was Mrs. Thatcher's avatar and anticipation. She was a woman named Mrs. Thurman, another Mrs. T, and she was the headmistress of my primary school in Birmingham in the late 1950s. And she wore beautiful blue suits, she was impeccably coiffured, she was enormously energetic. She had a terrifying temper, which reduced grown men to gibbering jelly. She was, unusually for someone who was a teacher, a confirmed Christian and a confirmed conservative. And of all the people who have been generous to me in my life, she was probably the first and in some ways the most significant. The motto of our primary school was "Only the best is good enough." And I didn't realise until much later in my life quite how much I owed to her. But my point is that when Mrs. Thatcher came along, I sort of thought I understood her in a way that most people in my profession either didn't want to do or weren't able to do, because Mrs. Thatcher was actually Mrs. Thurman multiplied by about 100. And Mrs. Thurman was pretty impressive anyway. But I sort of felt that because I had known Mrs. Thurman, I had a kind of instinctive rapport with and understanding of, though not always political agreement, with Mrs. Thatcher when she appeared later in life. So when the chance came for me to write about Margaret Thatcher, it proved to be absolutely irresistible. But let me try to explain how this did come about. I am, as Timmy has just mentioned, the general editor of the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, which has been around in its current guise since the early 21st century, but is a reworking of a great enterprise begun in the late 19th century by Leslie Stephen. And I am, and have been now for 3 years or so, the general editor. And it is a convention that the general editor always writes the life of the monarch who has just died. I'm the front man for the enterprise, and there are a set of research editors who do all the real work. And one of them said to me, the Queen is going to outlive you, so there's not the remotest likelihood you're going to write that life. So the next best thing is that you better write the life of Margaret Thatcher. And that, as it were, was how I ended up doing it, that I had been asked to do it, and I thought in the end I probably should. So the entry that I wrote on her, which is the origin of this book, which is essentially that entry reprinted with various additions and embellishments, the entry that I wrote on her was meant to be about 25,000 words, but I discovered or found that it was just not possible to write about Thatcher within that compass. And the book came out, or the entry came out, and it's that text which is in the book, at about 34,000 words. And that makes it shorter than the entries on Shakespeare and Queen Elizabeth I, but longer than any other entry, even longer than the entry on Churchill by Paul Addison. I'd rather hoped it would be a bit shorter than that, but in the end, anyway, it came out as longer than that. So on the scale of entries in the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, this is a very large piece indeed, even though, as I've already said, it's produced quite a short book, certainly a shorter book than Charles Moore's very wonderful two-volume and soon-to-be three-volume biography. And in writing this book, it was hugely interesting to revisit the 1980s that I had lived through, but to see them, as it were, as a period of historic time, and to see them as a period of essential biographical significance for Margaret Thatcher. And that, again, was part of the attraction of doing it, to write about a phase of my own life that I had actually lived through, as it were, the major phase of Thatcher's life. And what I tried to do in this book was to treat her with a combination of sympathy and detachment. Not an easy thing to do, for a variety of reasons. It seems to me, although I think an important thing to try to do, it does seem to me that historians or biographers writing about historical subjects, even in fact very wicked historical subjects, and I'm not suggesting Thatcher was that, ought at least to recognise that they are historical figures of serious significance. Historical figures are always more important than the people who write about them. And therefore, I thought it important to recognise, as I had in the 1980s, and as I was willing to do again, as it were, in the 2010s, that Thatcher was undeniably a figure of major historical significance. And I have tried in this book to do full justice to the extraordinary nature of her historical significance, her historical achievements, and on occasions, perhaps, her historical mistakes. But along with sympathy, that's to say the warm heart, there has to go, I think, detachment, or what Dennis Healy called the cold eye. That's to say one can't and shouldn't ever take a historical subject entirely at their own self-evaluation. Or, put another way, I tried in this entry on her, and in the book which has come out of it, to set her in a broader historical perspective and to try to suggest that some of the things that she claimed enormous credit for might in fact have happened anyway had she not been there, though recognising, of course, that she was there. And I suppose behind all that, although I don't think Thatcher would have applauded me for quoting this person, is, I think, the one sensible remark, the one very sensible remark that Karl Marx once made, although I don't think Thatcher would have thought he made any sensible remarks, but the one sensible remark he made, which is, men and women make their own history, but they do not do so under circumstances of their own choosing. And even if you were Prime Minister of Britain for more than 10 years, I think that remark applies to Thatcher, and I think it's helpful in thinking about Thatcher to get that sense of what she could do, but what were the limitations to her freedom of action that as British Prime Minister she undoubtedly had. And in the light of recent events, we scarcely need reminding that British Prime Ministers' freedom of action is not always as much as they would ideally wish it to be. So, in the light of that, let me just talk about three aspects of Thatcher, which I'd like, as it were, to single out from what I've written about her. They're not the only things about her that are important, but they are perhaps things that might provoke some questions and comments later in this session, which I'm very eager to ensure we have time for. And I want to talk about her origins, and I want to talk about her gender, and I want to talk about her reputation. All, it seems to me, very serious subjects about which there is still much to say. But let me say some things about those aspects of her life. It's hugely important, I think, to remember that Margaret Hilda Roberts was born in Grantham, Lincolnshire, in 1925, the younger daughter of Alfred Roberts and his wife, Beatrice. Although she distanced herself from her hometown at the very earliest opportunity, and seldom, if ever, felt nostalgic towards it in her years of power and fame, although, as it were, she constantly wanted to get away from Grantham, the fact remains that Grantham was hugely important in the life and mental makeup of the woman who achieved national renown and international celebrity as Mrs. Thatcher. Grantham is terribly important. I was in Hull a week ago doing a turn for their City of Culture on behalf of the Oxford Dictionary of National Biography, and the train took us through Grantham. And I tried to imagine what it must have been like for Thatcher to grow up in that town. And as we went through Grantham, I tried to imagine what it must have been like for her to be on the railway station at Grantham in 1943, going to Oxford as an undergraduate. She'd barely ever left the town or spent a night away from her parents' home before then. And I tried to imagine how important and significant Grantham must have been. Situated at the northeastern extremity of the English Midlands, Grantham was, and indeed is, a provincial market town on the main road, the A1, and the East Coast Railway, then the LNER, from London to Edinburgh, with a population holding steady at about 20,000 people throughout the interwar years. Significantly, thinking about Thatcher later, there was little by way of heavy industry or a factory-based working class, and its civic politics were largely consensual and non-partisan, except, as Thatcher remembered and regretted, in the case of the Labour Party. So here are some early influences which are not insignificant. The local grandees were the Brownlows, who lived nearby at Belton House, and the fifth Baron Brownlow had served as Mayor of Grantham in 1925, the year of Margaret's birth. There was no large-scale unemployment of the kind that was found in the manufacturing towns and cities of the north. Thatcher had no sense of the terrible hardship in manufacturing industrial Britain in the early and mid-1930s, in the way that figures of an earlier generation, like Harold Macmillan, MP for Stockton-on-Tees, did. Grantham may have shared some of the hardships of the late 20s and early 30s, and the economic recovery that came later in the years immediately before the Second World War, but it was certainly nothing like as bad as parts of the industrial north. Despite the excellent rail and road connections north and south, the great cities of London and Edinburgh were far away, not only geographically, but culturally and socially as well. So it's in this rather claustrophobic world that Thatcher grows up, and where her father, Alfred Roberts, was becoming a very big fish in a rather small pool. Alfred Roberts' father had been a Northamptonshire bootmaker from whom he may have inherited his unostentatious liberal politics, and in his sustained determination to improve himself and to be of service to his fellow citizens, Margaret's father might have stepped straight from the pages of Samuel Smiles's Self-Help, a book which Thatcher herself came very strongly to admire and to believe in. Alfred Roberts had left school at 13 because, being one of a large family, he needed to earn his living, and he went into the grocery trade. But he was also eager to make his way in the world, as befitted somebody who had read Samuel Smiles. And he did this, among other things, by voracious reading. Margaret would later say that her father was the most well-read man she had ever met, and she encountered in the course of her career some exceptionally well-educated and well-read men, so that was no small compliment. And also by his active involvement in the Methodist Church. By the time he moved to Grantham and married Beatrice, Alfred Roberts had saved enough money to acquire a shop on the North Parade, and not long before Margaret was born, he opened a second store nearby. From this base, Alfred Roberts launched himself into the civic life of the town. He was a lay preacher at the Methodist Chapel. He became a Rotarian and a Justice of the Peace. He was a local councillor, elected as an independent. He was a governor of Kesteven and Grantham Girls' School, and he would later become an alderman and serve as mayor of Grantham in 1945-6. So that's another piece of this Grantham jigsaw so essential in understanding Margaret Thatcher. Margaret Roberts, as she then was born above the family shop, and her upbringing was Spartan. There was no garden, the lavatory was outside, and there was no hot water. Her parents were not rich, although the family business would prosper in a modest sort of way. But Alfred Roberts loathed any form of extravagance and hated anything that smacked of self-indulgence. The domestic regime over which he presided was austere and puritanical, joyless and lacking in warmth. And if we want to understand why Margaret Thatcher, as many people said, had no sense of humour, Grantham is part of the explanation for that. At least twice every Sunday, Margaret and her sister were taken to worship at the local Methodist church, where their father often preached the sermon. From an early age, the girls were taught the importance of order, precision, and attention to detail. They were escorted on weekly visits to the local library to borrow improving books. As soon as they were old enough, they served behind the counter in the family shop. Conversation at home was earnest and high-minded, and Alfred and Beatrice rarely took holidays. Thrift, hard work, self-help, self-reliance and self-improvement were the governing imperatives of the Roberts household. Duty invariably came before pleasure, and public service before personal gratification. Integrity mattered above all else, and it was important to hold opinions because they were right and because they were true, not because they were popular. Here again we can see the beginnings of much of the later Margaret Thatcher. These were the lessons learned and the values internalised by the young Margaret Roberts, and as Prime Minister she would later celebrate them as the Victorian values which she believed had made the United Kingdom great in the past and which under her leadership would make it great again. "We were Methodists," she would recall, invoking one aspect of her father's legacy, "and Methodism means method." "Those poor shopkeepers," she allegedly exclaimed in the summer of 1981, invoking another aspect of her father's legacy on hearing of the damaged retail stores in the Toxteth riots. When Prime Minister, Thatcher would declare that she owed almost everything to her father. Her relations with her mother were never as close. Yet Margaret learned more from Beatrice than she would later admit, for although she would never be, to put it mildly, a conventional housewife, she liked to clean, to sew and to decorate and furnish the places where she lived. She would often provide late-night meals for her personal staff at 10 Downing Street, and she would elevate the domestic, Grantham-based verities of hearth and home into governing principles and political imperatives. "Some say I preach merely the homilies of housekeeping or the parables of the parlour," she told the Lord Mayor's banquet in November 1982. "But I do not repent. Those parables would have saved many a financier from failure and many a country from crisis." Alfred Roberts was self-made and self-taught, but he was determined that his daughters should be given every educational opportunity that he himself had been denied. Both girls attended the local primary school and later went on to Kesteven and Grantham Girls' School, of whose governors Roberts would eventually become chairman. There was scarcely any job in the town that sooner or later he didn't occupy. Margaret won a scholarship. She was serious, intelligent, competitive and hardworking, possessed great powers of concentration and was already hyperactive and seemed to get by with very little sleep. She kept her distance from other girls and in later life would much prefer the company of men to that of women. But she also played hockey for the school team, liked dancing and going to the cinema, and evinced an early interest in elegant and stylish clothes. She took elocution lessons, won prizes for recitations, and became a confident and well-prepared debater. Here again, we can see the makings of the person that she later became. She sat school certificate in the summer of 1941 and obtained distinctions in chemistry, arithmetic, and algebra. In the sixth form, she specialised in the sciences, particularly chemistry, because she believed they were the way of the future. And she may have been influenced by the fact that Grantham's most famous son was, of course, Sir Isaac Newton. She also evinced a growing fascination with the law from seeing her father in action in the magistrates' court. Margaret Roberts was brighter, more energetic, and more ambitious than her sister Muriel. And with the encouragement of her father, she set her sights on gaining a scholarship to Oxford University. The money mattered because the Roberts, though comfortable, were not rich. She sat the exam for Somerville College in the autumn of 1942, but narrowly failed to win an award. Instead, she was offered an ordinary place for the autumn of 1944 and resigned herself to filling in with an extra year at school, of which she now became the joint head girl. But, and here's an early example of the luck which she had for much of her political career, someone who had taken a place at Somerville for the autumn of 1943 unexpectedly dropped out. It was offered to Margaret Roberts and she accepted, her father being determined to find the money somehow. Margaret, her final school report concluded with perhaps inadvertent prescience. Margaret is ambitious and deserves to do well. Well, she was and she did. She would become a lifelong admirer of grammar schools, which she regarded as providing a ladder of opportunity for people from unprivileged backgrounds. And when she accepted a peerage in 1992, she took her territorial designation from her school, Kesteven, not her hometown, Grantham. Yet this, of course, ironically, would not prevent her as Secretary of State for Education between 1970 and 1974 from acquiescing, albeit reluctantly, in the closure of more grammar schools than anyone in her position had done, either before or since, a fact which she did find very difficult to finesse in the appropriate volume of her autobiography. Oxford was hugely important, second only, perhaps, to Grantham, because it would eventually provide the route whereby Margaret Roberts, however much influenced for life, as I think she was, by the Grantham milieu in which she had grown up, escaped the cloying limitations of what, of course, George Eliot famously called English provincial life. But the ancient university town was far from Grantham in more ways than one. And when she first appeared at Somerville, she had spent scarcely a night away from home. Try to imagine that. As a result, she was initially apprehensive, homesick and lonely, and having failed to win a scholarship, was almost always short of money. But then, as later, her response to adversity was to work harder than ever and to work harder than anybody else. As at school, she was an able and highly motivated student, but neither of the academics with whom she came into the closest contact considered her brilliant. Janet Vaughan, who became principal of Somerville, thought her a perfectly good second-class chemist. While Dorothy Hodgkin, the future Nobel laureate and probably the most eminent woman with whom Margaret Thatcher ever dealt, both would become members of the Order of Merit, rated Margaret as good, one could always rely on her producing a sensible, well-read essay. Well, any of us who have been to either Oxford or Cambridge and had tutors telling us we'd written a sensible, well-read essay know how much condescension is to be found in those words. Hodgkin, in fact, employed Margaret Roberts as her research assistant during her fourth year, and Margaret duly did indeed obtain a sound second-class degree. But here again is something very important to which I think insufficient attention has been given. For the rest of her life, Thatcher did retain a genuine and well-informed interest in science. And she would later claim that being the first British Prime Minister with a degree in one of those subjects was a more signal achievement than being the first woman to occupy 10 Downing Street. And I think the fact that Thatcher had done a serious degree in a serious subject was one of the reasons why she didn't have much time for all these rather grand figures at Christchurch or Balliol who had done politics, philosophy and economics, which didn't actually train you to do anything except to assume you had a golden path to 10 Downing Street. It's also worth noticing that the speech that she delivered to the Royal Society in 1988, expressing concern about global warming, would be the first by a major world leader. And it would be terrific to imagine Margaret Thatcher lecturing Donald Trump, or even perhaps Michael Gove, on issues of global warming today. Somerville tended to be left-wing in its political sympathies, and this was certainly true of Vaughan and Hodgkin. But Margaret Roberts had already espoused a very different creed, and once again, her father was the formative figure. By the mid-1930s, Alfred Roberts had become a conservative in all but name. He disliked the Cooperative Party, which controlled Labour in Grantham, and was opposed to independent shopkeepers like himself. Again, I think, a very important influence on Thatcher. At the general election of 1935, he signed the nomination papers of the local Tory candidate, Sir Victor Warinder. And at the time of Munich, he was an ardent supporter of Neville Chamberlain and his policy of appeasement. Margaret Roberts absorbed most, but not quite all, of her father's views, and her first direct involvement in politics was working for Warinder on polling day. At Somerville, she joined the Oxford University Conservative Association, and in her final year was its president. There she began to network in ways that were again of enormous value to her later in her career. She met such leading Tories as Peter Thornycroft, whom she would make party chairman in 1975. She campaigned in the general election of 1945 for Quintin Hogg, who was Lord Hailsham. She would appoint as her Lord Chancellor in 1979. She reorganised the University Conservative Association and increased membership. And as a young representative, as they were called, she began to attend national gatherings of the party faithful. So notice the way this is already beginning to develop. By the time then she left Oxford in the summer of 1947, Margaret Roberts was a very different person from the anxious and lonely figure who had arrived at Somerville 4 years earlier. She would never fully conquer the insecurities deriving from her lowly born status, but she was already set on a political career, and her views were conventionally conservative. Strong admiration for Winston Churchill, a firm belief in the greatness of Britain and its empire, support for the ideas of John Maynard Keynes and William Beveridge on unemployment and social security, and dismay at the outcome of the general election of 1945. But Oxford had not been all work and politics, though she certainly worked pretty hard both at work and at politics, because she had discovered a broader and richer social life than Grantham had offered. The University Conservative Association was a social as well as a political organisation. And despite being constantly short of money, Margaret Roberts enjoyed the dinners and the dances, and she always dressed well, borrowing clothes and jewels from her elder sister. Oxford also provided her first boyfriends, and she took one of them, Tony Bray, to Grantham, where he attended chapel with her parents on two occasions. It was not thought to be a particularly ravey or successful weekend. But by then, Margaret Roberts was distancing herself from her family and her hometown. And although she remained loyal to her father's values and example, her professional, political and personal lives would all be spent in London and the South East. And that geographical shift, for which Oxford, of course, provides the conduit, is, of course, hugely important in understanding how she becomes the person she did and how, indeed, Margaret Roberts became, in the end, Margaret Thatcher. After graduation, she found work as a research chemist, initially for British Zylonite Plastics, located at Manningtree, and subsequently with J. Lyons & Company at Hammersmith. But while these were her day jobs, her real passion was politics, and thanks to the connection she had made and cultivated in Oxford, her assiduous attendance at party conferences, and her impressive performances before the selection committee, she was adopted as a prospective parliamentary candidate for the Dartford constituency in Kent. There was no chance that she would win, since it was a safe Labour seat. But in the general elections of February 1950 and October 1951, when she was the youngest Conservative candidate in the contests, she campaigned with energy and determination, attracted considerable media attention, and very significantly reduced the Labour majority. She also continued to mix politics with pleasure. One boyfriend was a Scottish farmer, Willie Cullen, who would later, in fact, marry her elder sister, Muriel. Another was a doctor, Robert Henderson, who was twice her age. But on the evening of her adoption meeting for Dartford, she met a man who was, I quote, very reserved but quite nice, and with plenty of money, and who was a perfect gentleman. His name was Dennis Thatcher, and he and Margaret were married in December 1951. Like almost all of the men with whom she had gone out with before, Dennis Thatcher was considerably older than the woman who would one day make his name world famous. He had attended a public school and had served as a staff officer in the army during the Second World War, where he was mentioned in dispatches. He was active in the Dartford Conservative Association, but he had no political ambitions for himself. By the time he met Margaret Roberts, he was the manager of a prosperous family business which made paints, wood preservers, deck cleaners, and industrial chemicals. Notice the chemistry connection again, for which he had worked apart from the war years since 1934. He'd married Margaret Kempson in 1942, but by the time he was demobilised, she had left him for another man, and they divorced. Dennis was determined to remarry, but his careful courtship of Margaret Roberts lasted well over 2 years. Dennis was an ex-soldier. He was athletic and well-dressed. He knew about business and money. He had a certain style and dash, and he drove a Jaguar. This was not the Grantham she had grown up in. Although Margaret was the better educated of the two, Dennis was much richer, and he offered a passport to the home county's identity and respectability she was determined to acquire. Her marriage transformed the second Mrs. Thatcher's life, beginning with their honeymoon in Madeira, which was the first time she had ever left Britain and gone abroad. And she soon completed the task of distancing herself from her home, her family, her class, and her religion. Dennis reinforced many of her political views, especially her dislike of the Labour Party and trade unions, and her support for the British Empire in general and for white South Africa in particular. He also brought her the financial security she had not previously known, and she would never have to work for a living. But being a full-time housewife held no allure, and she decided to read for the bar, enrolling at the Inns of Court School of Law in early 1952. She passed her exams in December 1953, was called to the bar by Lincoln's Inn in January 1954, and specialised in tax law. The experience of mastering complex financial arguments would stand her in good stead in later life, and just as having a science degree was important, so I think was having a law degree, because she came to believe passionately that the rule of law was an essential aspect of freedom and democracy. And I think the fact that Thatcher was both a chemist and a lawyer is hugely interesting and important. In August 1953, so as not to waste time, she had given birth to twins, Carol and Mark. Margaret and Dennis were genuinely fond of their children, but he was often abroad on business, and she was determined that they would neither interfere with her legal activities nor thwart her political ambitions. The Thatchers could afford ample childcare, and Carol and Mark were sent away to school at the earliest opportunity. By this time, she was renewing her search for a parliamentary constituency that she could win, unlike Dartford. And in March 1958, she was shortlisted for the safe Conservative seat of Finchley, a moderately prosperous, petty bourgeois, owner-occupied London suburb with a significant Jewish population. That also of great importance. There were more Jews in Thatcher's cabinet than ever in any other before or since. She was adopted, and at the general election of October 1959, she increased the previous majority, and from what would turn out to be this secure and impregnable base, she would launch the most extraordinary political career of modern times. So the background is hugely important. The determination, the tenacity, the persistence, the courage of her convictions, the training in science and the training in the law. Or, as her enemies would say, her narrow-mindedness, her lack of humour, her lack of a capacity to see herself or to imagine herself into other people's lives and worlds. But there isn't any doubt that the Grantham story, via Oxford, as it were, to Dennis and the home counties, is very extraordinary. It's also, of course, utterly extraordinary, I'm now moving on to the second thing I want to talk about a bit, that she was a woman. In her period of prime and power, it's important to notice the many names by which she became known, and the varied, indeed contradictory, attitudes and identities, fears and fantasies that they suggested the political classes in general, that's to say men, projected onto her. She was the good housewife or the grocer's daughter. She was the Iron Lady or the Warrior Queen or even Britannia or Gloriana. To her admirers, she was Maggie or the Blessed Margaret, or less flatteringly, the Great She-Elephant. But to her opponents, she was that bloody woman or Attila the Hen. No male prime minister has ever been known by so many sobriquets. Was this sexism or was it celebrity or both? Thatcher and gender is an extraordinarily interesting subject. For the whole of her public life, Thatcher was a woman in an overwhelmingly man's world. And from one perspective, it's important to notice that she only reached the top by seeming to suppress the tender, nurturing, emollient qualities often associated with wives and mothers, and by demonstrating the assertive, domineering and aggressive attributes more commonly associated with alpha males. She was combative and competitive, she scorned consensus and compromise, and she constantly emphasised her willpower, determination, tirelessness and courage. She regarded her dealings with foreign heads of government, with her own cabinet and with the civil service as trials of strength she was determined to win, and she almost invariably did. And the same was true of her performances in the Commons, especially at question time, where she eventually achieved an unrivalled mastery. As President Carter's national security advisor, Zbigniew Brzezinski, put it in a comment that may say as much about him as about her, in her presence you pretty quickly forget that she's a woman. She doesn't strike me as being a very female type. Indeed, as both party leader and prime minister, she seemed to be not so much a real woman, but much more of a male type. Hence, as some of you will perhaps remember, the puppet caricature of her, created for the satirical television programme Spitting Image, where she was dressed in a man's business suit and wearing a tie, and where her demeanour was unfailingly harsh, abrasive, assertive and severe. It was all of that which led Barbara Castle, perhaps the most famous and successful woman politician before Thatcher, to complain that Thatcher was completely insensitive to the particular difficulties that ordinary women faced when struggling to deal with a home, earn a wage, deal with an elderly parent and sickness in the family. She had even less sympathy with the left-wing female activist who protested at the arrival of American missiles at Greenham Common, and feminism was a cause and a creed to which she was wholly unattractive. She was viscerally opposed to any form of politics built around adversarial group identities, and she preferred to think of people as individuals rather than as collectivities going into battle to achieve shared goals and objectives. She had no time for positive discrimination or affirmative action, and she regarded the very idea of the mutually supporting sisterhood of women's libbers as incomprehensible. And significantly, during her 11 years of prime ministerial power, only one other woman sat in Thatcher's cabinet, Baroness Young, of whom I suspect hardly anybody has ever heard, who was briefly leader of the Lords from 1981 to 1983. But at no time during her premiership did any other woman sit on her Commons front bench. Nevertheless, there was one woman with whom Thatcher had to do business throughout her prime ministership, a woman, moreover, who had been at the very top in domestic and international politics way before Thatcher had been heard of, and who still is long after Thatcher has died. And that, of course, is the Queen. Although born within a few months of each other, the Prime Minister and her sovereign were never natural soulmates in the way that Thatcher and Ronald Reagan were. They came from different worlds, socially, culturally, geographically. Unlike Thatcher, the Queen was an instinctive paternalist in domestic matters, preferring consensus and compromise to conflict and confrontation, and in foreign affairs she was devoted to the Commonwealth, for whose leaders Thatcher had little time and even less respect. In 1986, the Sunday Times would run a story deliberately leaked by the Queen's press secretary that she was dismayed by her uncaring Prime Minister, which the palace never explicitly denied. Relations between Premier and monarch were scrupulously correct, but they were never warm or friendly. Yet although in this sense Thatcher disliked and didn't get on with other women, she did also appear in a variety of quintessentially womanly guises, one of which was what Hugo Young called the de-eroticized female devoid of sexual attraction or allure. She was feared or denounced as a virago or a fishwife, living in a permanent state of outrage, quarrelsomeness and bad temper, and making the most stout-hearted men feel inadequate and apprehensive in her presence, back to my sense of Mrs. Thurman in an earlier time. Alternatively, she was the fierce headmistress, here is Mrs. Thurman, keeping an unruly class in order, or the dragon sister on the hospital ward ensuring that male patients took their medicine, or the stern nanny teaching the boys to eat their vegetables. This was how she behaved when chairing cabinet meetings, announcing at the beginning of each item for discussion the conclusion that she wanted reached. And that was how she treated the briefings from ministers and civil servants, returning them peppered with comments, underlinings and question marks. In yet another guise, she was a latter-day Queen Boudicca, urging her troops into battle, who delighted in donning combat gear or being photographed in a British Army tank. Or she was Lady Bracknell, a century on, for whom the handbag was an instrument of womanly aggression rather than an essential repository for makeup and other female necessities. Time and again, Thatcher made it plain that she took a dim view of the male species. If you want something said, she once observed, ask a man. If you want something done, ask a woman. But Thatcher also took trouble to present herself as an appealing and alluring female. She was always impeccably coiffured, her eyes were sky blue, her skin was clear, her complexion fair. She applied carmine lipstick in considerable quantities, and she invariably wore high-heeled shoes to draw attention to her elegant legs. She took great care with her clothes, often changing her outfit several times a day, and preferring well-tailored suits in strong colours. She also exploited her gender, treating her cabinet colleagues in a way which no male prime minister could have done, brushing fluff from their shirt collars, straightening their ties, and buttoning, but not unbuttoning, their jackets. What is more, during the Falklands War, she came to feel a particularly strong affinity with men in uniform, and she also had a weakness for handsome males of a certain age who stood up straight and wore well-cut suits, and who may have reminded her of Dennis's earlier style and dash, and of which type Cecil Parkinson and Alan Clark were conspicuous examples. Indeed, Alan Clark found Thatcher's combination of political authority and sex appeal extremely attractive, and she knew it, and she played up to it. Thatcher was also the beneficiary of the still prevailing code of male gallantry, which meant few of her colleagues or adversaries were willing to stand up to her or pay her out in her own confrontational coin. One of her backbench critics, Julian Critchley, admitted that Tory men had been brought up to believe that it's extremely rude to shout back at women, while Neil Kinnock conceded that as Labour leader, he felt inhibited at Prime Minister's question time from being too aggressive. And indeed, in the early meetings of the Shadow Cabinet, when Thatcher walked into the room, all the men stood up. As the undisputed alpha female of her time, Margaret Thatcher was thus a bundle of gendered contradictions, which by sheer force of personality she concealed and carried off with sustained bravura and compelling conviction. She was also supported throughout her time at Downing Street by a husband whose money had made her public career possible and who self-effacingly subordinated his life to hers. But while she was, after her fashion, a devoted and appreciative wife, she was always a more distant than nurturing mother. Carol, of whom she did not think much, went off to make a career in Australia, while Mark, on whom she doted, was packed off to Dallas in Texas after some controversial involvement in arms dealing in the Middle East. Let me give two quotations which illustrate the paradoxes Thatcher denied and the inconsistencies she exploited, which made her the remarkable woman of power she eventually became. At the end of the Falklands War, she held a dinner at 10 Downing Street for the men in uniform who had contributed most to the victory. Their wives were invited to the postprandial reception, and at the end of the meal, Thatcher stood up, addressed the assembled company and said, "Gentlemen, shall we join the ladies?" Sometime after, President Mitterrand, who did not make his predecessor's mistake of treating her as a grocer's daughter, described Thatcher in very different terms, declaring that she combined the eyes of Caligula with the lips of Marilyn Monroe. It is not clear by which he was more impressed or intimidated. A final few words, if I may, and then, of course, I'd love to hear from all of you about this extraordinary woman on Thatcher's place in history. Remember that Thatcher got a funeral, a ceremonial funeral, not a state funeral, at St. Paul's Cathedral. And those magnificent obsequies invited comparison with those earlier recorded in the same church to Nelson, Wellington, and Churchill. Did her life and achievements rank on the same epic scale as theirs? The answer to that question is very complicated, but because it's Thatcher, it's also very interesting. From one perspective, the answer must be no. The reconquest of the Falklands was an audacious military campaign in which much bravery and great resourcefulness were displayed, not least by Thatcher herself, and which temporarily boosted national morale. But this late colonial expedition was not a victory to equal the Battle of Trafalgar or the Battle of Waterloo or the Battle of Britain, either in the scale of the conflict or, despite her claims to the contrary, in the world historical significance of the outcome. However insistently and repeatedly she talked her country up, Thatcher's Britain possessed fewer ships than in Nelson's day, fewer troops than in Wellington's, and fewer fighter planes than in Churchill's, and this perforce limited what she could achieve on the global stage. But from another perspective, these comparisons worked to her advantage, for all three were born in circumstances and places more advantageous than hers. Nelson, the son of a clergyman in a Norfolk rectory, Wellington, the younger son of an earl in Dublin, and Churchill, the grandson of a duke in Blenheim Palace. In making her life's journey from the Grantham grocer's shop to St Paul's Cathedral, Thatcher travelled further than they did and had a much higher mountain to climb. Moreover, and in other ways, such comparisons fail to do Thatcher adequate justice, since they are, of course, all with men. Yet it was as a woman in the overwhelmingly male world of politics that she was both uniquely disadvantaged, but also, and here is an extraordinary paradox, uniquely successful. And as Prime Minister for 11 years, she set a record for continuity and endurance in the highest office in a man's world that was unrivaled by any figure since Lord Liverpool. Throughout her premiership, she was the dominant figure in British public life. At her best, her energy was tireless, her stamina inexhaustible, her courage dauntless, and her patriotism beyond question. For much of her time as Prime Minister, she commanded the Cabinet, the Civil Service, the Commons, and parts of the country to a degree and for a duration which no other Prime Minister in modern times has come remotely close to rivaling, let alone equaling. And on the international stage, she possessed a star quality which no world leader in her day could equal and which no 20th century British premier has attained, with the exception of Winston Churchill himself. She was a force of nature. And for a time, it did seem as though she would go on and on and on and on. And the unrivaled ascendancy that she achieved, and not only despite but also because of her gender, is vividly caught in a question which, well into her time at 10 Downing Street, a young boy put to his father. "Daddy," he said, "are men ever prime minister in this country?" Such remarks could not be made about any other premier. As a woman of power, there was no one in modern British history with whom Thatcher may be compared. And I think it's fair to say that the claim that Theresa May was going to turn out to be another Margaret Thatcher has not been wholly borne out by recent events. It's worth noticing, however, that in fact Thatcher was not the first nor the only long-serving female prime minister in the second half of the 19th century. Consider Mrs. Bandaranaike in Ceylon, consider Indira Gandhi in India, consider Golda Meir in Israel, and consider Benazir Bhutto in Pakistan. Interestingly, some of them got there before Thatcher, some of them stayed in power after Thatcher, although again many of them enjoyed advantages Thatcher did not, coming from political families. Let me draw these remarks to a close. Thatcher's prime ministership combined a unique personal story with an extraordinary political dominance, and both were rendered the more remarkable on account of her gender. She also cared greatly about her posthumous reputation, but the verdicts of historians are neither uniform nor final, and that's just as well, otherwise people like me would go out of business very soon. To her admirers, she was the saviour of her country, who put the great back into Britain after decades of decline. Domestically, she tamed the trade unions, reversed the trend towards nationalisation, rolled back the state, created a vigorous enterprise economy, and forced the Labour Party to accept the brave new world she had created. While internationally, she raised the Anglo-American relationship to levels of intimacy and importance not seen since the halcyon days of Churchill and Roosevelt, pioneered privatisation, which many other countries subsequently took up, and played a major part in ending the Cold War and in bringing freedom and liberty to Eastern Europe. But to her critics, Thatcher was a narrow, provincial and vindictive ideologue whose hard-faced politics were devoid of social compassion for the less well-off, increased inequality by legitimising a culture of greed and by cutting taxes on the rich, undermined such bastions of liberal decency as the civil service, the universities and the Church of England, and destroyed the United Kingdom's sense of national solidarity and civic pride, while failing to invest the profits derived from North Sea oil and privatisation in the country's long-term future. These views were not and are not easily reconciled. Although there is some agreement that Thatcher performed better before 1986 than after, and also that she achieved less than she set out to do or claimed that she had done. Domestically, she failed to curb public spending significantly. She did not change popular attitudes regarding the welfare state or the enterprise economy. And far from rolling back central government, she increased its intrusiveness and control in many areas of local and national life. As a global figure, she may have been the first to recognise the emergence of Gorbachev and that that might lead to the ending of the Cold War. But the unintended consequence of that was that Britain's influence in the United States and in Europe was diminished, not enhanced, while in the case of German reunification and the collapse of apartheid in South Africa, she was emphatically on the wrong side of history. She was also, and this is a point that a historian rather than a biographer would make, the beneficiary of deeper historical trends and long-term changes which had nothing specific to do with her. The recession of the late 1970s and early 1980s was a global phenomenon, which resulted in a widespread turn to the right, not only in the United Kingdom, but also in the United States, West Germany, Canada, Denmark, and Norway. In all of those countries, the desire to cut public spending, to balance the budget, to allow market forces free play, and to cut taxes became the stated aim of government policy. And in Britain itself, the shift from a northern-based industrial economy with a manual, unionised working class to a consumer-oriented, white-collar service economy, increasingly concentrated in the southeast of England, would have happened whoever might have occupied 10 Downing Street. By her determined and assertive leadership, Thatcher persuaded people in Britain and elsewhere that she was in command of events and knew what to do and how to do it. She became the only 20th century British premier to give her name to an ideology. But Thatcherism was a political phenomenon rather than a coherent policy. She stressed her unswerving convictions and dislike of consensus, yet she could be more cautious and compromising than she ever admitted in public. She possessed some simple core beliefs, but when it came to cutting public spending and income tax, to selling off nationalised industries, and to dealing with Europe, she often made things up as she went along. She stressed her integrity and preached the politics of morality, but she repeatedly resorted to dark and devious means to undermine her cabinet colleagues. She relished battle and was a good cabinet butcher, devoid of sentiment or scruple, yet she was deeply hurt when she was finally paid out in her own coin. She abhorred class politics, but invariably championed the lower and middle class, and she disliked the traditional working class, the public school educated upper middle class, and most of the aristocracy. She was deeply and romantically patriotic, but this was not easily reconciled with her belief in free markets, liberal economics, and globalisation. As Peregrine Worsthorne once observed, and this is my final quote, she sought to make the world safe for the Victorian values of her father, yet in reality she made it safe for the much more suspect ethics of her son. Thank you.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.